When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a brilliant guest. He has been very outspoken over the last few years. He is a doctor, specifically a cardiologist and an internist, and he works in a hospital in Dallas. And this is the one and only Dr. Peter McCullough. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm in a clinic in Dallas. I actually don't work in the hospital, but can't believe I finally made the Zuby podcast after all these years.
Yeah, it feels like it's long overdue. Yes, thank you for correcting me. Clinic rather than hospital at the moment. So I've done a brief intro there, Dr. McCullough, but for people who are not familiar with you, please tell them a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, as you can see, I'm a doctor. I'm in my clinic right now in Dallas-Fort Worth area. I hold degrees from Baylor University, University of Texas Southwestern Medical School, the University of Michigan, and Southern Methodist University. And additionally, I've done internal medicine training at the University of Washington in Seattle, cardiology training at what's now the Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. And I've held academic leadership positions in medicine and cardiology my entire career. And when the pandemic hit, I was well positioned because of the internal medicine and cardiovascular aspects of the illness to direct my research and scholarship towards the pandemic. I was the first to publish a treatment approach of how to treat patients with the illness to help avoid hospitalization and death. And now I'm on the verge of being the first doctor to publish a treatment approach to help people get out of trouble with these vaccines.
Interesting. So I first heard about you, I want to say was it 2020 or 2021? It was before you went on the Joe Rogan podcast, but it was during the height of, let's be honest, the absolute madness that was being experienced all over the world. I'm from the UK. I assume you were in the US during the majority of it, but I was in the UK. I also traveled to multiple different countries. I actually went to 7 or 8 different countries during the 2020 and 2021 time period. And I don't think in my lifetime, or perhaps even before it, there's ever been a single event which has affected so many billions of people around the world simultaneously. The world lost its mind, for lack of a better term. I think a lot of people think this is something that, oh, you know, it was just the US that was like this, or it was just here, or it was just there, but it was all over the place, different continents, different nations, lots of stuff that didn't make sense. Now, of the doctors who spoke up and spoke out about it, of course, you were very much one of the few at the forefront of that. And again, not just in the US, but globally. But I'm curious to know, now that we're in mid-2023 and the temperature has calmed down and the restrictions have dropped and the crazy policies and mandates and the back and forth and the fighting and the discrimination and the segregation and everything that happened, right? That everyone's trying to pretend none of it happened now. What are your overall thoughts now, say a year plus removed from it all and reflecting back to that time period? What are your general thoughts on what exactly happened?
Yeah, I think your statement about the world lost its mind is correct. I know in medicine, the House of Medicine quickly failed Americans and people all over the world. People were falling sick, and they expected to get treated to avoid two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death. And doctors didn't do it, and nurses and others didn't do it. And before we knew it, the hospitals and the governments wouldn't let the doctors do it. So then it became unavoidable that people would get sick. They would get so anxious, breathless, so dehydrated that they would ultimately capitulate and come to the hospital. You know, most of the people who are hospitalized with COVID, they weren't put on life support by the paramedics. The paramedics picked them up and they were actually reasonably okay. They were brought into the hospital. And then the average patient who died with COVID, they died weeks after the hospitalization.
That's interesting. So what do you think happened? I mean, it seems like there were failures at every single level of everything from mm-hmm. the very beginning, from the modeling to the communication to the pharmaceutical companies, to the public health officials. I know you have a master's in public health. Mm-hmm. The political angle, the scientific angle, the medical angle, it just seems like across the board, in my viewpoint, and I was saying this from early on in 2020, and I continued to during the period, but none of it made sense. None of it seemed to be making sense if the goal was actually to help people and to reduce disease and to take care of people's health holistically, then there were so many things like on every level that to me, this is what set off my alarm very early, is I was just like, this doesn't make sense, right? You're locking things down and you're stopping people mm-hmm. from going outside. You know, the thing doesn't spread outside, but you're telling people not to go outside and stay inside. You're closing down gyms and healthy outlets, but you're opening fast food restaurants and you're opening this and this, and you're telling people not to wear masks and then to wear masks and then you're forcing them. And that it just, I can't even get into all of it. It was so many layers of things that just didn't make sense to me. And then, we got the actual vax rollout and it got even crazier.
Right. So here's the thing. You could take every single aspect of pandemic response and say it was incorrect. And that is a true assertion. But I think it's probably more instructive to say what should have happened. And in November 19th, 2020, I testified in the U.S. Senate. I was the lead witness for the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. So I was literally able to tell the nation what we should do. And then I subsequently chaired a five-hour session in the U.S. Senate on January 24th, 2022. And then I also chaired a co-moderated a session in December 7th, 2022. And the framework of what should have happened, and I've published on it now, is called the four pillars of pandemic response. That we should have had four pillars, four things that we were working on all the time. And because it was an emergency and we had all the resources available, we should have had teams of the best and brightest people come to Washington, work together, and then message out to the country and to doctors and hospitals what we should have been doing. So here are the four pillars. The first one is contagion control. That is reducing the spread of the virus. What we learned is the only effective method of reducing the spread of the virus was viricidal nasal washes and sprays. So that include povidone iodine sprays, colloidal silver, xylitol, know, even salt water works to some degree. And then gargles, Listerine or Scope works fine. Iodine or peroxide enema is fine, but about 30-second gargles. So if that's done pretty intensively when someone's sick, it decreases spread massively. Actually decreases it probably about 80%. The PCR turns negative in about 3 days.
Can I jump in right there? Because I think what you've just said, that's not something that was in any type of mainstream communication in any country as far as I'm aware.
Right. So what I'm saying is everything was wrong. So the one thing that worked, now the question is, when did we know that?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're up to 17 studies, 12 randomized trials, 3 big trials with hard outcomes. So this is solid. This is very solid. We knew this, and this was solid by January of 2021. So I can tell you, as a doctor, I didn't even know about this in 2020. I got COVID myself. I didn't know that an iodine spray would work up in the nose or a gargle, and I didn't do either one. You know what? I sat there, congested, sore throat, and then it went into my lungs, and I was cooked. Mm. So let me tell you, I learned my lesson. Now that we have the data, I'd never travel anywhere without a little bit of iodine or xylitol or the both. So there's many things that work. On my podcast, America Out Loud Talk Radio, we've had Nasal Hygiene Summit. We've had multiple programs on this on my website. And on America Out Loud, there's all kinds of information on how to use these sprays and gargles. And we've messaged it out hard. In 2021, it became such a big deal that Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace, you know, did a big story in Epoch Times. So why is our government not telling Americans about nasal and oral virucidal sprays and washes? Because the virus was so transmissible, masks and things weren't going to work, but we actually needed to kill the virus. We need to actually kill the virus. And you don't kill every single viral particle, but you kill enough to where you don't spread it so readily. And clearly it reduces its ability to invade. So that was the hugest advance. We rely on it today. I'm in practice. I have a community pharmacy next to my clinic here. They make a special, a special spray and gargle that has xylitol, povidone iodine, vitamin D, EDTA, or cartagena. There's so many things that work. We had one of the real knowledgeable people in the field on America Out Loud, and he was reviewing everything for us. And he said, you know what works, believe it or not? Dilute baby shampoo in little kids. Dilute baby shampoo works. Even salt water. People who went out in the ocean and just snorted up some seawater, that worked to some degree. What we found out, sadly, though, is that quickly the U.S. FDA and Federal Trade Commission sued every single company that made a nasal spray or a gargle for COVID-19. Oh. Yeah. Okay. And this was so bad. We found out about it. So wait a minute. Why is the government was not just telling people about it, they were impeding the ability to bring this innovation to the population.
Okay. I have two questions on this because I'm not so familiar with this nasal irrigation program, but specifically on this point, is this number one, is this something that works as well for flu? Is that something that people can be, because obviously the flu's been with us for a very long time,
right?
And I've never heard this being recommended for the flu either. So is it something that's equally or even more effective for that?
It works for flu, works for the common cold. And the literature has really grown on this. This is solid. There are now dozens and dozens of papers showing it reduces the viral concentrations. It works against viruses, bacteria, and other fungi. And the companies struggled because they couldn't get out and market and promote these products because the government tied them up legally.
Okay.
And still to this day.
The second question I have on that is, of course, that's US focused, but what about all these other countries? Because this was an international thing. So did other governments also have this blocking of this technique or these products? What happened on an international level then?
It was mixed. We heard about innovations. You know, the biggest trial that was done by Chowdhury and colleagues from Bangladesh. It was the Bangladeshis that did it. But do you know that in Finland, they had a nasal spray that actually had antibodies against SARS-CoV-2 as a commercial product?
I did not know that.
So, yeah. So it was mixed all over the world. The parts of the world that got the message really did well. If you noticed the tropics, anywhere where people lived around salt water, they did very well. You didn't hear about it down in the Caribbean, places like that around the coast. They did great. The worst thing for COVID was to stay indoors. You mentioned that.
And, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also with that, you had the people were not getting vitamin D.
Yeah, vitamin D, but just reducing the viral load. So one of the first things in the McCullough protocol, that's what it became known and copyrighted as. I published this in August of 2020. First thing I said in terms of what to do in the protocol was get outside. Get outside. And when this hit in Dallas in 2020, I told my patients, listen, front porch or back porch, you figure it out, but get outside. I do not want you inside, because people inside were quickly filling up all the air with the virus and they were just rebreathing it. So the worst would be to be in a New York City skyscraper or in Milan in one of these closed brownstones or in Wuhan. Wuhan's a very vertical city too. But that was the worst. And if you noticed out in rural areas, you didn't hear about COVID disasters nearly as much out in rural areas when people got away from all that high density living.
Yeah. And look, as a non-medical expert, as a layperson in this sense, from the beginning, that seemed obvious to me. I know that one of the primary reasons why people get so many more colds and flus in the winter is because people are spending more time indoors, and
right.
It spreads. Any respiratory virus like that is more likely to concentrate in the air and spread indoors. But the message was literally the opposite. This is the thing that there's many things that continue to bother my mind to this day. Is it was literally do not go outside, stay inside, lock yourself down, you know. And it was, I'm just like, wait, isn't it the opposite? And then of course, you know, the response to me is, hey, you're not a doctor, listen to the experts, shut up, whatever. And I'm just like, wait, just logically, this isn't making sense to me from multiple angles.
Right. Well, the one thing we've learned in COVID-19 pandemic response is anything that violates your common sense, trust your common sense over it. So do you remember the vignette? We actually have this in my book, Courage to Face COVID-19. There's a guy, he's out in the bay in San Francisco, and he's on a paddleboard. He's way out there.
Yep.
And they go out there in like a rescue boat to arrest him for not wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. Or you've seen these terrible videos in Australia and in the UK and other places, Canada, where the police are tackling people and they're and with all that physical contact, if somebody had COVID, they're really going to spread it once they're choking somebody and they're doing all this horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. So the four pillars, the first one is contagion control. We should have had a group on this. And we would have quickly learned masks don't work, social distancing, lockdowns. Now, it turns out in Scott Atlas's book, who's a contemporary of mine, he's at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. He was in the White House for about 9 months with Trump and the team. And Atlas kept advising them, listen, you know, masks aren't going to work. Don't lock down the country just to protect the seniors. And in fact, there was a document that came out in October of 2020, Bhattacharya, Kulldorff and Gupta published it. It's called the Great Barrington Declaration. You're probably aware of it. I signed off on it. About a million, you know, top scientists signed on it and said, listen, just protect the seniors. You know, it's a real disease, but the world doesn't need to lock down. So that was that first part of it. Now, the second pillar, most important pillar, and that's the pillar that everybody fell down on. That's early treatment. Just like with pneumonia, cellulitis, deep tissue infections, anything, we must treat it early. So that was the biggest shortcoming. All governments should have had immediate early treatment programs, at least encouraging the hospitals and the doctors to have early treatment programs. But, you know, instead of having early treatment programs, you know what most clinics did? They closed their doors. Most hospitals, went on to kind of emergency mode only. And to this day, there's not a single major medical center in the United States or worldwide that had a major outpatient treatment center. Can you imagine this? All these people getting sick, they needed something to help them stay out of the hospital, and none of the hospitals opened their doors. In fact, the biggest one was in Marseille, France, by Didier Riault, and he had an outdoor tent, and he managed a ton of people. He treated tens of thousands of people, and they were constantly trying to shut him down. He's undergone all kinds of regulatory review, a professional reprisal, just for keeping people out of the hospital.
Yeah, this is the thing. And I still feel this way, you know, 3 years on from the onset of all this is, look, I like to assume the best of people. And I like to, I prefer to assume incompetency over malice. But so much stuff happened during this time period that I struggle to genuinely believe that this was just incompetence. I don't see how you can have incompetence on that type of scale. Multiple cities, multiple states, multiple countries, multiple places, like all, like how did all of, if it were a bit more random and like some places handled, did it well and did stuff that makes sense and others fell into the goofiness and whatever. But it was just like, how are all these places moving in lockstep with the same nonsensical policies, the crazy masking stuff, the one-way systems on the thing, the random 6 feet or 2 meters apart, the locking down healthy people in their homes, the campaigns that followed after with the jabs and this. Like, it, if a couple places didn't make sense, then I'd be like, okay, I understand that. But everywhere, right, with the exception of like the continent of Africa and, you know, Belarus and Sweden in Europe, but pretty much everywhere else, you know, they marched in lockstep on this. And for me, this throws up a huge number of questions because I'm just like, I don't know, when I hear people talk about it now, it's just like, oh, you know, people didn't know, it was just incompetence. And I'm like, man, there's more here. There's more here. And I'm not even trying to lead you down any particular path on this one. I'm just, I struggle to think that this is mere incompetence.
But think about how important early treatment was. By December of 2020, a paper by Gukliakos and colleagues, I know I'm the senior author, you know, they concluded that we had clear and convincing evidence that early treatment worked, that starting with the virucidal nasal washes and sprays done every 4 hours, it took about 4 to 6 drugs to get even the sickest patient through COVID at home. It didn't depend on any single drug. No single drug was necessary nor sufficient. Protocols came out of United States. I had the most widely used one in the world, but came out of France, South Africa, Central America, and they all worked. They used different, you know, groupings of drugs. But if the governments worldwide just left doctors alone, just said, listen, you handle it, it's your problem, we don't have anything to say, this pandemic would have been over a long time ago, and we would have avoided most of the hospitalizations and deaths. I mean, the people who are hospitalized and died is because they didn't get early treatment.
Yeah. And again, that seems obvious. I'm not aware of, there's probably exceptions to this, but with every disease that I'm aware of, it's better to, well, firstly, to treat it, but also if you're going to treat it, to treat it early. Right? It's, you know, prevention ideally, and then failing that, early treatment. And, you know, the earlier it could be cancer, right? The earlier you catch it and the earlier you treat it, then the better, because it's done less damage. This seems common sense, but it's not just that wasn't offered. It's that those who tried to offer it were blocked. And that's where I'm like, okay, that seems malicious to me. I guess the best interpretation of it could be, oh, you know, they're trying to protect people from, you know, dangerous untested things or whatever. But then, speaking of dangerous untested things, that, you know, leads into another topic. Let me not get myself banned off anything. But yeah, I don't know. I'm fully mind blown from it, because not a lot of people want to talk about the whole pandemic period now, because I think a lot of people are, honestly, I think a lot of people are ashamed of it and ashamed of how they behaved. But I think it's important, because this is, you need to go back and dig stuff up and learn the lessons. Like, what are the things that went wrong, right? There were some very catastrophic errors. And if we can't talk about it openly, then how are we going to prevent this happening again?
Well, I wanted to comment on your, you know, your inflection there about whitewashing. My son just graduated from medical school down at University of Texas in Houston. I was there at graduation. In fact, I was on the stage for the Roby. And his medical school class lived through the beginning, the middle, and kind of the tail end of the COVID pandemic. They were influenced greatly by this in terms of the class, the patients that came in, vaccines, the whole thing. And the graduation, multiple speakers, a guest speaker, the dean, the head of the student body, not a single mention of COVID or the vaccines. And this is at the largest medical center in the world.
Interesting.
Can you imagine that complete global whitewash? As if it never happened.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing. So let me get to the third pillar. The third pillar is late treatment, hospital treatment. And so how hospital treatment should have gone is we should have had updates once a month. All the major health systems in the United States should have been conferencing once a month. And we should have had comparative statistics. We should have learned which hospitals had figured out how to have the lowest use of the ventilator, the shortest amount of time on the ventilator, and the lowest mortality. Do you know, 3.5 years later, there still are no comparative statistics. We don't know which hospital did the best or the worst. There was no collaboration. No hospital developed their own protocol. I went on Tucker Carlson in 2021. I saw Tucker. I said, there's still no Harvard protocol. There's no Mayo protocol. There's no hospital that's innovating, coming up with, you know, like of a blue ribbon medical center, coming up with an innovative strategy. Americans don't know where to go. They were just pouring into any hospital. Mm-hmm. And so the hospital care never advanced. And then the final pillar number four is vaccination. Now, vaccination could play a role in a pandemic. By the way, vaccines have never ended any pandemic so far. Never. They've never ended a pandemic. So this was the first time of trying to use a vaccine in a pandemic. But what they can do is they could have potentially protected some high-risk patients. They can't end the problem. And so, you know, I was thinking in my mind, if we had a perfectly safe and effective vaccine, maybe 2.7 million nursing home patients, people domicile situations. And so I was co-leading one of the vaccine development programs called Imodulon. And it was a cellular-based vaccine, and it was a company out of the Netherlands. We had the FDA, the NIH, back and forth, back and forth. We thought maybe a broad cellular-based immune. It's similar to the BCG vaccine given elsewhere. You may have had that actually against tuberculosis. So the point is our governments and governments around the world had no interest in this. It was only an interest in these genetic vaccines like messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA vaccines largely. And our vaccine idea never had the light of day. But it was only sketched out for, you know, residents of these facilities and the workers where there was documented spread. It was never in my mind, you know, to vaccinate the entire population or even six-month-old babies. I mean, I just couldn't conceive of that as a doctor. We weren't seeing children having serious outcomes. So the four pillars of pandemic response are reduce the spread of the illness. That would have been with viricidal nasal sprays and washes. That'll be true with the next pandemic. Second pillar is early treatment. That'll be true with the next pandemic. We'll probably need to use, you know, generically available drugs early. Number three is in-hospital treatment must improve, and the hospital systems are going to have to share comparative data. That's the only way we can improve and share best practices. And then lastly, vaccination. I'm not hopeful now. The COVID-19 vaccines, which I'm sure we'll get into, they were a complete failure. The pandemic is still going on, despite 2.5 years of vaccination. So,
yeah, let's talk about the vaccination situation now that it seems legal to do so.
Yeah.
What happened there? I mean, you touched on something which I remember at the time. I remember in the time where the red flag went up really high for me was not the sort of December 2020 period when the shots were being offered primarily, I think actually only just, I think in the UK, they started with people over 65. And then I think it maybe moved to 55 plus. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, my alarm, I did have questions about, well, what about long-term effects and how effective it could be and so on, just because it, you know, it's so new and it came out so quickly. But in terms of the reason why they were doing it, it didn't throw up a lot of red flags for me. But then when they started getting to under 30s and under 18 and children and babies and people who are not even having a rough time with the disease, that's where I'm just like, wait, this is a gigantic red flag to me, because right. if this is really about public health and not making billions and billions and billions of dollars, then why are you injecting 2-year-olds and babies with this thing? Like, that doesn't even 15-year-olds who are healthy. None of that. It makes total sense to me from a business perspective, but from a public health perspective and genuinely caring about people perspective, I mean, I said at the time that it was utterly insane. And, you know, lots of people did agree with me. But also, you remember how angry people were at that time period and how divisive it all was. And people are there, you know, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer, you're crazy, you want people to this, you want this, you want this. I'm just like, guys, like, think about this. This isn't making sense. Just like you don't give chemotherapy to someone who doesn't have cancer, right? Like, I'm not against the medicine in theory, right? I'm not against, but if you don't need it and it's being pushed on you, then yeah, that's weird. And then they started all the incentive programs where they were like offering people all sorts of things, ranging from a voucher to visit a brothel in the Netherlands to free cannabis to lotteries to cheeseburgers and French fries in New York City. And now my red flags are just going crazy. I'm just like, this is very, very bizarre. All the songs coming out, people dancing and making songs about the vaccine. And I'm just like, am I the only one who thinks this is weird? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah. You know, I tell you, my red flags came out earlier. Of course, I was following this in the first year of the pandemic. I was by invitation writing op-eds in The Hill, which is a widely read journal for the House of the Senate and the White House. You know, I'd already been on the map in terms of publishing the first treatment protocol or testified in the U.S. Senate. So, I was already a major, probably the major public figure in the COVID-19 response at that time. And I published an op-ed in The Hill in August of 2020. And the title of it was The Gamble, The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccines. And I was laying this out for America. I said, wait a minute, this is a gamble. These are brand new genetic technology. The gene, the genetic material that's injected codes for the lethal part of the virus. And you can't control how much is going to be produced. I go, this is the lethal part. They didn't pick a benign part. The lethal part of the virus, and some people, it's going to kill them because you can't control how much of it's made. It's a lethal protein. It's lethal. It's been proven to be lethal. And we knew this. So I was like, wait a minute. And so that when they went through the clinical trials, you know, they strictly excluded people with prior COVID, suspected prior COVID, women at childbearing potential, pregnant women, children were excluded. And so my red flag came up the very first week. They were rolled out December 10th, 2020. And you know, in that first week, there were pictures on the internet. Over 3,000 pregnant women took the shots. 3,000 in the United States. I said, wait a minute, just 2 months earlier, they were strictly excluded from clinical trials. The FDA and institutional review boards. Yep. And the people in the vaccine centers, they weren't nurses or doctors. They were just community volunteers or other people. I mean, who was applying some medical prudence here to do this? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that really struck me is I thought for sure those who had COVID before the vaccines, they would just be exempt. You wouldn't have to take it. You were done. In many ways, I was kind of glad I got COVID early. Me and my wife got it. We got through it. And so it's like, you know, it's like, whoo, good. We're not going to need a vaccine. We're good. And then when the vaccine program came out, I said, well, just take it anyway.
Yep.
I said, no, wait a minute. I already had the illness. I'm good. Yep. And there were already three papers out early. Raw, Kramer, and Mathudius. Mm-hmm. Showed that if people already had COVID and they took the shots, the side effects were through the roof.
Yes.
So you would definitely not want to take a shot once you've had COVID.
And that the natural immunity was at least, but most likely much stronger and more robust than vaccine induced, which would also make sense given what we already know about immunology in the human body. It's crazy. As we talk about it, it sort of transports me right back to this period because I'm just remembering having these conversations with people on Twitter and in real life. And I'm just like, what is going on here? And just for people who are listening to this podcast, you wrote that article on The Hill, The Great Gamble of COVID-19 Vaccine Development. You published that August 2020.
Right.
So that's early.
I'm the only public figure who questioned the vaccines ahead of time. So it goes to show you the groupthink. There wasn't another chief of medicine or anything else. And, you know, Scott Atlas was publishing op-eds in The Hill as well. And we were trading emails. Yeah, and Scott wrote his book. You know, he never mentions my op-ed. He actually never mentions McCullough Protocol, which was published in August of 2020. I was like, Scott, wait a minute. You spent 9 months talking to the president about masks and social distancing. What about treating people? The president himself got early treatment. He got a form of the McCullough Protocol. It's like, wait a minute. So, you know, this came full circle because when Joe Rogan got sick, he basically got the McCullough Protocol, and so did Aaron Rodgers and all these other public figures.
And then was demonized for it. Horse medicine.
Yeah, that's the reason why Joe reached out to me. But there were, you know, public figures that were notable. For instance, Kirk Herbstreit, my favorite ESPN college football announcer. He gets COVID early in 2020, like I did, has post-COVID syndrome, gets through it. So then he takes some shots in March of 2021, blood clots. He gets blood clots, pulmonary embolism, threatens his life. It's just a total mess in doing that. You would never take a shot once you've already had COVID. And that there was also many other unnatural things. So the pregnant women piece of this was a terrible paper by Thorpe and colleagues, first author, I'm a senior author, shows horrendous outcomes, multifold increase in fetal loss, stillbirth, multiple fetal abnormalities, growth retardation, maternal hemorrhage and fetal hemorrhage at birth. You know, now a paper by Hoyert and colleagues published from the National Center for Health Statistics on the CDC website, March of 2023, maternal mortality is at a record high. Highest risk group, African-American women. We now know 65% of women who delivered babies through the pandemic took the shots either before or during pregnancy. And you know who is the poster child for this is so sad is Tori Holt. I don't know if you saw her situation. She's a U.S. Track and field champion. Won the she won the Tori Bowie. I'm sorry, Tori Bowie. She won the one of the relays 2016. U.S. Track and Field Association forced the vaccines on the runners. She's found dead at home 7 months into the pregnancy. With the baby. Baby's dead and she's dead. She's kind of in the process of probably a stillbirth. This doesn't happen. People with means and access to healthcare, this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And these are the types of outcomes we're seeing now with the vaccine. So none of this made sense. Another thing is vaccines, to be minimally acceptable in medicine, they have to be at least 50% effective and at least last a year. Otherwise, you wouldn't want to keep taking shots. It became quickly known the vaccines last less than 6 months and that people have to keep taking boosters. Mm-hmm. So taking boosters of a novel genetic product that is coding for a lethal protein now every 6 months, we have no idea if this protein would accumulate, would it have cumulative toxicities? How does the body dispose of the genetic code? There's all kinds of fundamental questions because it was never studied every 6 months forever and ever. And if one is following the program right now, they're on their seventh shot. Now, do you know anybody on their seventh shot?
I don't know. I also have a policy of not asking people. I have a lot of people who voluntarily tell me their vaccination status. Not so much these days, but you know.
But have you heard any public figure?
Seven. No, I think the most I've heard is perhaps five.
But let's say President Biden, former President Trump. By the way, both vaccine promoters. How about anybody in the UK?
Definitely no public figure has, I think, openly come out and said, yeah, I'm taking, I don't think I've heard of anyone taking a booster this year.
Okay. That's very interesting. So the official stance of most governments is still take a shot. The CDC today had an ad out saying it's safe and effective, but no one will come out as an advocate and say they're on their seventh shot.
Mm-hmm. The science changed, didn't it?
Well, the attitude
that's the line
changed.
I hear.
And
right,
I can
I'm
tell
just
you
saying, what, that's the line I hear.
You know what we're lacking is we're lacking honesty
Yes.
If people are not on their seventh shot, mm-hmm. why not?
It's ego protection. That's what it is. I think our podcast today is sponsored by The Wellness Company. Did you know that nearly 90% of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. are produced overseas? That's an alarming statistic. If you don't have an emergency kit on hand, it's time to get prepared. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit contains 8 potentially life-saving medications that every single American should keep in stock. It comes with a 22-page instruction guide on safe medical use for everything from snake bites to COVID to bioterror events. Another stellar product from The Wellness Company is Spike Support. Whether you got vaxxed or not, the virus is still among us in some capacity, as well as the related spike protein. Spike protein can cause brain fog, tissue damage, blood clots, and more. Spike Support is a detoxification powerhouse that aims to strengthen the body's natural immunity and flush out spike protein, so you can get back to that pre-COVID feeling. Get both of these products by going to twc.health/Zuby and get 15% off with the discount code Zuby. That's twc.health/Zuby and use discount code Zuby to get 15% off. Disclosure, the medical emergency kit is only available to U.S. residents.
Look, I honestly think from a lot of stuff has gone on from a psychological perspective. I find the whole situation, I find the psychology of it all far more interesting than the virology or epidemiology or anything else. And I think what we have now, I think the reason why people are even trying to memory hole it is because, number one, I think, look, if you've injected something into your bloodstream and it's potentially dangerous or harmful or has harmed people, if you did it yourself, let alone you advocated that other people should do the same or even tried to force or bully people to, then that's a lot of, you know, that's too much for most people to bear and to be open about, right? I think there's also the degree of ego protection. I think if you've been running around saying that anyone who doesn't, you know, if you were running around in 2021 and early 2022 saying that anyone who doesn't take this thing is an idiot, is an anti-vaxxer, is stupid, is anti-science, is whatever, and then it turns out that they possibly had some good points or that they were, you know, correct in some cases, then again, I don't think most people's egos can, I just don't think most people's egos can deal with that. So I think instead people would rather pretend to just say, hey, the science changed, it wasn't me. I never said all those horrible, awful, nasty things that I said about other people and how they should lose their rights and lose their ability to live normal lives. So I'm just going to pretend that none of this ever happens. And, I understand that psychologically. I think.
But you have to admit that's pretty unique because people, I think, more readily admit other shortcomings. People will say, well, yeah, I was a drug abuser and it was a mistake. I was an alcoholic. I committed a crime. It was a mistake. I think another piece of very unique psychology here is it's now known this stuff doesn't leave the body. Mm. So the messenger RNA doesn't look like it breaks down. The spike protein is in the body. As long as we keep looking, we keep finding it. People are staying. They feel sick for a long period of time. There's a paper by Lee and colleagues showing little micro blood clots floating through the retinal veins and arteries for 2 years after these shots. I think what's going on, it's not like, you know, admitting a flaw, like, I had an affair, I was an alcoholic. They're thinking to themselves, oh no, I took these shots and I bought the farm. Now everybody is in a relative state of personal terror. This is what's keeping people quiet. I had a kid come in my office last week. He's a young kid, went to college, came down to see me. He looked me in the eye deadpan and he said, Dr. McCullough, am I going to have a cardiac arrest? And I think that is the subconscious play going on in everyone's minds right now. And that's explaining the behavior. No one will come out and tell you that they're on the seventh shot. No one will come out and tell you, I took these shots and I regret it and I want to take action. They're in this kind of state of overall panic.
Yeah, I've had a small number of people say that to me privately. But I think that as long as the establishment, including the political class, including the media, all the people who, you know, pushed and promoted and forced this thing on people, they're not willing to admit any type mm-hmm. of error. They're not even willing to draw the obvious connections. Look, at this point, I personally know people who were, I know young men who were in good shape, who took the shot and were hospitalized, heart attacks, myocarditis. Mm-hmm. Like, it's real. Like, I don't know the official numbers, but of the people I personally know, let alone friends of friends, I personally know people where that situation happened. Right. And someone else might be like, hey, well, I also personally know people who were, you know, young and healthy and in good shape, who had a really rough time with the virus itself. Right. Mm-hmm. And I can acknowledge both of these things, right? Both of these realities. Sure. Most people were okay and seemed to be okay regardless. But these situations happen. And in these cases, even when they go to the hospital, the doctors themselves don't even want to draw any potential connection between these things, right? That we had that whole situation. It was what, 2021, 2022, where lots of athletes, you know, around a particular time were having heart attacks and were dropping on the field and this and this. And you're supposed to sort of completely suspend your brain and think that there's no even possible connection. Like, I'm just there thinking, okay, isn't this something that should at least be investigated, right? Like, I can't say 100%, and I wouldn't say 100% every single one of these cases, you know, it's the jab. Like, you know, I'm not intellectually dishonest in that sense, but I'm like, okay, well, some of them, like, are we going to just pretend there's no connection here at all? And it's just the sort of mass level denial.
Aren't some of these psychological processes, they're contiguous with what was happening before the vaccine? We saw things that weren't making sense. People weren't following the common sense. Let me give you some official numbers so you can have your audience can have them.
Please do.
So our CDC VSafe, which is the CDC's safety database that people self-report how they're doing on their cell phone, 10 million people, you know, signed up and did this program. 7.7% of Americans who take the shot in the next day or two end up in the ER or they're hospitalized. 7.7%. That's how toxic this is. So let me tell you, the shot is a doozy. And they get hospitalized for a whole variety of things. But can you imagine a shot where 7.7% chance you're going to get so sick you can't even survive? You got to go to the hospital. That's the first data point. Two prospective cohort studies, one by Mansugian and the other one by Mueller, Asia and Switzerland, respectively, show when you measure everything at baseline and then in follow-up, 2.5% of people who take the shot get heart damage, myocarditis. The number is 2.5%. Now, in terms of athletes dying, a paper by Polycretus and myself, I know because I'm one of the most published people in COVID, so I'm very active there. In a stable period before the pandemic, the rate of athletes dropping in the European leagues, pro and semi-pro, age under 35 active players, that's the restriction here, 29 per year before COVID. Now that number after the vaccines is 283 per year annualized. It's about a tenfold increase. What we know, paper by Holscher and colleagues, I know because I'm the senior author, shows conclusively that by autopsy, the myocarditis can be fatal. Period. It's fatal.
Yeah.
So the FDA says the COVID-19 vaccines cause myocarditis, where I have 800 peer-reviewed papers on COVID-19 vaccine-induced myocarditis. And you're right. The next athlete who drops or the next person who comes in with a myocarditis syndrome, doctors and nurses and people are looking at these patients and saying, it's not the vaccine.
Yeah.
And people are saying, I don't trust you. I can't believe you. At this stage, I can't believe that people are denying the fact that it's the vaccine. And I think the reason why they're doing it is because they psychologically, they can't handle it. They took the shots themselves. They can't handle this.
Yeah, it's scary. It's deeply concerning, both the actual results of what is happening to a lot of people, but then also the denial of it, because how can you address a problem if you're not even allowed to discuss the possibility? You can't even be like, okay, maybe there's a link here, right? We don't know 100%, but this should certainly, oh, look, we've seen a tenfold increase in this since a certain thing was rolled out. Maybe we should look into this. Maybe we should check. And I feel like with any other situation, any other medical product, any food product, anything, like if something else came out and it had these type of numbers, like I remember a few years ago, I remember when Samsung released, was it their Note 7 phone? I don't know if you remember this. And like people were charging them and a small percentage of them were like exploding or catching fire. It might've been 1% of these phones, right? You could see videos on YouTube of these phones catching fire. And there was a massive outrage. They had to recall the entire, like everyone who bought the phone, they had to, recall, they had to compensate people and so on. And, that's for an electronic product. That's not for something you actually put into your body. There have been other drugs that have gone out and people have been like, oh, wow, this has, bad side effects and this and that. And people are talking about it and, the drug gets pulled or whatever it is. And it's just this, the level of defense of this one, not just from the pharmaceutical companies, which would make sense, right? That's in their interest, but from just the lay person, even people who have been harmed. I mean, I remember those situations where someone literally ends up in a hospital or something and they're talking about, I'm glad I got it. And I recommend you go and get it too. And I'm just like, bro, you're in a hospital. You're in a hospital bed after doing this. And you're telling me to go get this. Like, what is going on?
Right. I have to tell you, what myocarditis worries me the most. This is really important. This is we learn by cases, what's called sentinel cases, where we have information. And in medicine, we never really know the truth. We make observations, we do studies, and we try to approximate the truth. It's called inferential thinking. That's what's used in medicine. The case that worries me the most by far is European basketball player Oscar Cabrera Adames. This is a very important case. So he has a cardiac arrest on the floor, just face down. I don't know if you've seen some of these face plants. When they go down, it's just down like a ton of bricks. He's resuscitated. He tweets out, he says, I have myocarditis from the vaccines. So it's clear, he's honest about it. I got myocarditis. Then he tries to rehab. I'm sure he's taking medicines like I prescribe patients. He's doing everything. And he's in this process of readiness to return to pro sports. And he's in a health center and he takes a treadmill test and he dies on the treadmill test. He dies. Oh. They can't resuscitate him. So listen.
What's this man's name?
His name is Oscar Cabrera Adames. Look him up. Adames. This case to me really, really worries me because he took the shots in 2021. He dies in 2023. So the fear is, and there's a recent paper by you and colleagues in Circulation showing that once the myocarditis occurs, some young people, these athletes, they get scars in the heart. The heart has physically got a scar, and then the scar is the nidus for an abnormal heart rhythm that's provoked with exercise. It's called reentrant ventricular tachycardia. It degenerates to ventricular fibrillation and people die. I think this is what happened to Adames. It's the reason why that USC basketball player, Nick Uwichuchu, he had a cardiac arrest. They put a defibrillator in him. They probably, they used what's formed a subcuticular ICD, I imagine, so he can still play. But we're going to have players that have defibrillators in them. And the thing that's... Now, Adames comes out and said he got myocarditis, but Nick on USC, he never admits it's myocarditis. He never makes any public statements. He gets an ICD and continues to play. You have Damar Hamlin, Buffalo Bills. He says it's due to tackling somebody, but it's obvious, another obvious case of myocarditis. LeBron James' son just had a near miss cardiac arrest. You've had all these players in the UK. And in Europe.
And this is the thing is this, and this is famous people. This is people who are,
this is famous. But why
every pro athlete, how many normal people are there?
Right. That's a good point. There are people just in our public view. Can you imagine how many people are not in our view? They're just passing away. Let me say this. There's something in the minds of people where even when a family member dies, the other family members don't feel compelled to come out and warn others.
I've seen this. I have a friend. I have a friend, and this happened.
Well, Well, listen to this. A Democratic Congressman Sean Casten from Illinois is pushing the vaccines publicly. He's tweeting he's going to take the vaccines. The vaccines are going to save us. He's going to vaccinate his kids. Couldn't wait to vaccinate his kids. Takes his kids in, gets vaccinated. And then his daughter, Emily, perfectly healthy girl, is going to go to college next year. She's found dead in bed. Found dead in bed. Now, Casten doesn't come out and say, listen, this is terrible. I want to warn other people. I've lost my daughter. He looks like he's in a trance. And, you know, I can tell you in two similar cases, a paper by Gill and colleagues published in Archives of Pathology, two boys in Connecticut, ages 16 and 17, they take Pfizer and they die on days 3 and 4 after Pfizer. They're found dead in bed, perfectly healthy boys. They do autopsies and it's confirmed fatal vaccine-induced myocarditis. So this is not equivocal. This isn't a guess. This happens. A paper by Holscher and colleagues shows that the myocarditis is fatal. When these athletes go down, it's myocarditis until proven otherwise. Because, listen, they get checked out before they go into these leagues. They have EKGs. They have echoes. They're fine. They're not going to have a cardiac arrest on the field unless they take the vaccine. So when Damar Hammond went down on Monday Night Football, I went on Tucker Carlson the next night. Hamlin at this time is in the ICU. He's on the ventilator. Doctors are saying all kinds of things. I go on Tucker Carlson. I said, Tucker, he's going to be fine. He's going to walk out of the hospital. You know, right there. People are like, how do you know, Dr. McCullough? It's because I'm a top shelf cardiologist. I know what I'm talking about. I know what the outcomes are going to be. He's going to walk out of the hospital. He's going to be fine. I said, but I need to know if he took the vaccine. He probably did because 95% of the pro football players were forced to take it. And if he did, it's probably vaccine-induced myocarditis. And the issue is, does he get a defibrillator? What medicines does he need? In general, we don't let the players return to sports because it could provoke another cardiac arrest in general. But having said that, we're seeing some different outcomes with the vaccine. I did have a chance to firsthand see pilot Bob Snow. You probably heard about his case. He took the vaccine. A couple months later, he had a cardiac arrest in DFW Airport on the jetway just after he landed a plane. Fortunately, the paramedics were at the gate next door and they resuscitated him. He survives. In his mind, it's clear. He was fine. He took the vaccine. It caused the cardiac arrest. He got one of the subcuticular ICDs and he showed it to me. And it's now been about a year and a half later. And I asked him an important question. I said, has your ICD gone off? Has it shocked your heart again?
Sorry, what's an ICD? I'm not
familiar. An ICD, I'm so sorry. It's an implantable cardio defibrillator.
Got it.
An ICD is what people have. It's like a pacemaker, okay, but it's implanted in the chest. I'm so sorry I didn't explain it. He didn't have an ICD. So it actually shocks the heart internally. It's our main guarantee that someone will, you know, if they have a cardiac arrest, they're going to survive again. Virtually everybody who has a cardiac arrest in America has an ICD implanted, and Pilot Snow included. So I've been watching Damar Hamlin. He's on the Bills. It looks like he's practicing now. I can't tell if he has one of these ICDs or not, the newer form. Clearly, the USC player has it. You know, you can feel better. But I think it's interesting that the cardiac arrest was a one-time thing for Pilot Snow. Now, of the athletes, by the way, who die, UK and the European leagues, we know this, that when they die, about two-thirds of the time, when they have a cardiac arrest, it's fatal. They just can't get them back, or no one's there with a defibrillator, or they don't have an ICD. And then about a third of the time, they can survive. So I want to bring people the news that it's survivable. You know, in the minutes left, we probably should talk about something positive, and that's detoxification.
Yeah.
We've been working on how to get this spike protein out of the body so people don't have to worry so much.
Yeah. Before we talk about that, can you explain a little bit about, you know, I think a lot of people hear the term spike protein, but can you give a sort of layman level overview of exactly what the spike protein is and why it causes such a problem for many people?
The virus is a ball. Everybody is now, I think, familiar with the virus being a ball, and it has spines on the surface. The spines or the little buds or spicules, that's the spike protein. And it's a pretty big protein. It was engineered in this Chinese biosecurity lab. It's not a natural protein. That's the problem. And the spike protein makes the virus invade the body. It contains all the infectious and lethal aspects of the infection is all in the spike protein. The ball itself is pretty benign. So the spike protein is the problem. And what we've learned is that the spike protein, once it gets in the body, the human body can't get rid of it. It doesn't get broken down by normal human enzymes, and it's stuck in the human body. Bruce Patterson, who's at Incell DX, a diagnostic company, has shown spike protein after the infection stuck in the body, at least the outer segment, stuck for a year and a half. Mm. With the vaccine, he's shown the full-length spike protein stuck in the body at least 9 months. That's as long as he's looked so far in the studies. So we think it's relatively permanent, and that's the reason why people feel sick. People, they get COVID, long COVID, vaccines. They feel bad for years afterwards because every study has looked at it. The spike protein's in the brain. It's in the vital organs. The body's loaded with this stuff. And people are taking vaccines every 6 months. They keep getting another dose of the genetic code, coding for the lethal protein, the disease-causing protein.
So, okay. So just to be clear, people are getting this both from the infection and then from the mRNA shots, which are supposed to help keep them, you know, theoretically out of hospital.
Right. So the shots are giving spike protein. COVID's giving spike protein. So to review, the spike protein damages the heart and causes myocarditis, damages the brain and causes stroke. Hits the adrenal gland, the spinal cord, so it changes blood pressure. It directly causes blood clots. It's actually found in the blood clots. And then it really damages the immune system. It causes multi-system inflammatory disorder and others. Actually, the body is hyper-responding to this spike protein. So the spike protein is a real problem. And so what we've undertaken is our best scholarship, our best clinical acumen and our practice experience to try to come up with a way that people can get the spike protein out of the body. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is doing no research and no drug company is doing research helping us here. So no one will acknowledge the vaccine is playing a role here. So this is up to clinical judgment. I've checked clinicaltrials.gov. I'm a big time researcher. Listen, I lead big clinical trials. There's nothing. So we'll say, Dr. McCullough, you know, what can you do? We're using a Japanese product called nattokinase, derived from the breakdown of soy by Bacillus subtilis natto, a special bacteria. The Japanese have been eating natto for about a 1,000 years for its health benefits. For the last 20 years, they use it as a cardiovascular supplement. It's a mild blood thinner. It's available in a capsule. Two capsules twice a day is the appropriate dose, 2,000 FUs or 100 milligrams twice a day. Nattokinase, huge. Multiple studies shows it dissolves the spike protein, and it's a blood thinner. So it's just exactly what we need. The best in class is by the Wellness Company, a Canadian-based company operating out of the United States and Canada. Wellness Company, Spike Support, the best in class product. It has some other ingredients in it that are helpful. The second item now shown to partially degrade the spike protein may accelerate clearance is bromelain. Bromelain is derived from the stems of pineapples. It's a family of enzymes. Also, we need to help the body get rid of this stuff. And then the last is another natural product. It's derived from turmeric. It's called curcumin. Curcumin is in a sense derived from a spice, and it doesn't dissolve the spike protein, but it helps the body manage the fragments so there's not so much inflammation. Those three are considered base spike support: nattokinase, bromelain, and curcumin. We have a major paper coming out on this in the peer-reviewed literature that I'm going to disseminate it across the platforms. But right now, it's the base, and that's what we're doing in practice. And people say they want to add other drugs to it, fine. But people need to go on this probably 3 months minimum, some people out to 12 months to get ahead of this spike protein.
No doubt. That's useful. And I think for full transparency, I know people know this podcast for the past few weeks is sponsored by the Wellness Company, and you are their chief scientific officer.
Right. So I advise the company.
I don't want anyone listening to this thinking, oh, this thing's like,
oh, yeah, yeah. No.
It's an infomercial, or he's just trying to push his products or anything like that. This is, I just want to address that for transparency.
Right. Full disclosure. I'm the chief scientific officer. I advise the company on a minor part-time basis, and it's not a big deal. People can get nattokinase from any natural store on Amazon. So yeah, no conflict of interest there. And of course, bromelain and curcumin, any natural store there. So there's no conflict of interest to be concerned about, but we are concerned about people who are sick. I uniformly recommend it. Now there's a few caveats. One, bromelain, which is, by the way, an FDA-approved drug used as a topical agent in burns, just so you know. So it has medicinal effects. Bromelain and nattokinase are, they can cause bleeding because they're blood thinners. But most people have taken the shots are having blood clotting, so we need these. But if there's excessive blood bleeding, bruising, we have to make adjustments. That's a caveat. And then there can be allergies, particularly to the, so a little bit of soybean oil that could be in the nattokinase. So people, if they have a soy allergy in general, I tell them not to use it. But base spike support conceptually, just like McCullough protocol became the standard of how to treat patients with acute COVID-19, base spike support has now become the standard to treat long COVID and vaccine injury syndromes. It's the base of which we can do other things now.
No doubt. Dr. McCullough, before we close out, I've actually got, it's not connected to exactly what we've been discussing, but it is linked to it. And this is a thought I have because I was talking with a friend recently about how something sort of strange and interesting that's happened over the past few years due to yourself speaking out and, Martin Kaldorf, Jay Bhattacharya, mm-hmm. Dr. Robert Malone, certain people. And then, of course, you have the Faucis and the public health officials of the world and so on, is there's been this sort of strange rise in the sort of famous or celebrity doctor almost, right? I mean, you see what I mean, right? You've got over a million people now following you across these channels. Many of these people have become, massively, both loved and reviled, depending on, people's viewpoints on these things. But what's the best way to put this? How do you avoid what we could call audience capture, right? This is something that can happen as a podcaster, as a social media influencer, as a YouTuber, whatever. You build a large audience and it can be difficult to remain honest, right? I think this is a problem that, Fauci had, right? I think he's like, hey, look, I'm in this spotlight and people are viewing me as this sort of hero, almost as a sort of deity figure for this period of time. And with that, the science or the medicine or what's actually best for people has the risk of taking a hit because of the function of the ego and the celebrity and the fame and the this and that. So I guess my simple question is how do you and how will you avoid that, right? How do people keep the science and the facts and the data as the reality and avoid the sort of cult of personality taking over and seeping into that as it's done with, honestly, a lot of other, public intellectuals or scientists or even you could extend it to politicians. It's a problem that can happen, I guess, with any level of fame, respect, notoriety, celebrity, whatever someone wants to call that.
I'd say two things for a doctor. One, are they actively practicing medicine? If they're seeing and examining patients wearing a white coat, having to look somebody in the eye, make decisions, that's huge. So many of the doctors you mentioned, by the way, don't see patients. They don't. So they quickly get lost in their theories or their audience popularity. So seeing patients is number one. In fact, of the doctors you mentioned, I could be the only one seeing patients. The second is publication in the peer-reviewed and preprint literature, scientific publications. Now, I have over 70 peer-reviewed scientific publications on the topics. That's tops of any doctor you've mentioned, probably anyone in the world. Those two things, because scientifically, I've put my concepts down on paper and I've put it out there to be bantered about, to be criticized, what have you, in a formal, structured way. It's seeing patients and publishing are the two things. I think, honestly, that's the reason why I have the top doctor account on Twitter of doctors to see patients, because the fact that I'm grounded, people know that. the same thing. If, you know, that's the reason why I was the lead and I co-moderated the two major U.S. Senate hearings. Now, I was a public figure before COVID, so I had already testified in the Congressional Oversight Panel. I was the endowed visiting lecturer at Harvard in 2019 in two divisions. I lectured in the European Medicine Agency, widely lectured across the UK, elsewhere. Some of these other people you mentioned, they were unknown before COVID. They were not public figures before COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think COVID brought people out. It's terrific. People are out and exchanging ideas. I think we should finish by saying, if we can exchange ideas like we did today all over, that's going to be the answer. Yes. Right now, I've written the American College of Cardiology. I said, listen, we got to discuss this. People are having cardiac arrest. Have you, you know what?
Yeah.
No answer. No answer. Yeah. They shut me down. They shut me down.
I was going to ask on that note, Dr. McCullough, has anyone, I've seen, you know, YouTube videos and tweets and articles and whatever, you know, challenging you or questioning you, especially after your appearance on Joe Rogan, I think back in 2021. Has anyone, or have you done any debates about people with other doctors who have different views on the vaccines or the protocols or anything like that? And if not, is that because you haven't sought to, or that's been open and no one has been willing to step up to the plate and have an honest conversation?
Yeah. I mean, it's open to credible people, right? So, I mean, Joe Rogan contacted me and I said, Joe, I'm not going to debate some high school kid or what have you. I said, you know, a doctor who has many hundreds of publications, a chief of medicine, a dean, an editor, somebody of my stature. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to debate some Las Vegas comedian.
What about like a Peter Hotez? I know he was running away from it.
Yeah. Well, you know, RFK, Peter, but yeah, Peter Hotez, he's a bit older than me, but he's junior to me in academic medicine. He has fewer publications and accomplishments, but I messaged out to Rogan. I said, listen, I'd be happy to go over vaccine safety. I'm a data safety expert with Peter Hotez. I said, but it will come out that Hotez had biodefense grants with the Chinese on COVID-19 back in 2016.
Oh boy.
I said, it'll come up. It's right there. I mean, he was in on this.
Oh,
and so, you know, as soon as it became known that Hotez was part of this with the Chinese, he's pretty much evaporated, by the way, out of the media. He's pretty much gone. And
Fauci's gone as well. Fauci's fully disappeared.
Yeah, fully disappeared. So that's the other thing, the disappearance of people. I haven't disappeared. I was a public figure at the very beginning, treating patients. Everyone knew this. I started Tucker Carlson on his journey for 2 years. You're blowing my mind. You're blowing my mind. I set all the records on Joe Rogan for a reason, and I'm still here. I've been very clear. I cited the data today on this interview, which I always do. And in the America and basically the world now trusts me, I think, more than any other doctor alive. And it's not going to stop here. Sooner or later, everybody we talk to is going to have to face me. It's just going to be a hard reality for them to do so. Sooner would be better than later.
No doubt. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you. After all this time, I've been following you for a few years at this point now.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm grateful for you speaking up. I'm grateful for you challenging a lot of the narratives and the, you know, quote unquote science, not just now, but since before this thing even rolled out.
Yep.
And I think that takes a remarkable level of courage and insight and honesty. Very few people worldwide have done that and perhaps even had the sort of intellectual chops to be able to. But I think even those who did lack the courage. So that's right. Something I, and I know many other people, massively respect. And where's the best place for people to find and follow you online if they'd like to find more of your work and insights?
The best central place is my personal website, petermccullohmd.com. That'll take you everywhere. But, you know, I started a new foundation, McCullough Foundation. So mccullohfnd.org. That's providing great support for a scholarship. A lot of work I'm doing in the legal and public policy arena. I have a podcast, America Out Loud Talk Radio, McCullough Report, every Saturday and Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, then on the Apple iHeart Podcast Network. It's the top medical podcast in the world right now. And then Courageous Discourse Substack. That's the top medical Substack in the world. And again, it's just the same principles. is that we cite the data, we're very clear. And, you know, I work with best-selling author John Leake on my book, Courage to Face COVID-19. We have a whole series of publications. And, you know, I picked the right team. I picked probably the world's greatest historian right now. He's already a best-selling author. You know, our book, Courage to Face COVID-19, is the only book that reads quickly like a professionally written book. All the other ones are written by doctors or lawyers or politicians, and they don't read. A book has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Characters that develop. CourageToFaceCOVID.com is where you get it.
Awesome. Dr. McCullough, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like a pain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.